moved on to prove himself in other parts of the firm, focusing mostly on European options markets, which were more electronic. In short order, he became one of Hall's top electronic trading strategists. Then, in 1999, Goldman Sachs shelled out $500 million to buy Hall. It marked a massive shift inside Goldman, the quintessential old guard white shoe Wall Street firm, toward electronic trading. The shift would pave the way for Goldman's rise to power in the 2000s, when it emerged as one of the most aggressive and sophisticated trading goliaths in the world. Bodek was conflicted by the move. A giant Wall Street bank had suddenly swallowed up his life. He'd always thought of himself as an outsider who played by his own rules, a maverick who happened to have the mind of a world-class scientist. Hull, a hothouse of eccentric PhDs and boy wonders like Bodek, encouraged his outsider self-image. Goldman, on the other hand, was the epitome of the establishment, of faceless Wall Street power. He decided to stick it out, to discover what Goldman was like from the inside. He felt in ways like a spy who'd penetrated the enemy's inner sanctum. He'd see what it was all about and decide for himself whether it was good, evil, or neither. At Goldman, Bodek became a cog in the market's rapidly evolving machinery. The system was becoming increasingly electronic, driven by powerful computers that could execute trades in less than a second. Human dealers, the NYSE specialists and NASDAQ market makers, were getting pushed aside by the computer networks, electronic pools designed by experts such as Dan Matheson at Credit Suisse, where the trading algos designed by experts such as Bodek could face off and do battle. When Bodek had first joined Hull in 1997, the pools had only existed in embryonic form and weren't yet large enough for his AI trading system to work. By the early 2000s, the entire system was in flux. The new pools evoked a water-filled world of frictionless trading. Island, archipelago, liquid net. Some were fully transparent, or lit, such as Island, where all orders were out in the open, reported by electronic data feeds that anyone could access. Others, such as LiquidNet, were dark. Trading took place in secret, beyond the prying tentacles of the hunter-seeker algorithms. With electronic innovations, such as Island and LiquidNet, and the rise of algorithms that swam in their pools, the market was evolving like a living organism, shape-shifting into something entirely new. And the algorithms were changing, too. They were no longer the dumb, single-cell, virus-like creatures operating on simple orders. Has Microsoft's average price risen 1%? Buy. They were learning how to adapt in the new pools, morphing into more advanced predators. Many were geared up with advanced AI systems that could quickly detect hidden market signals using the high-bandwidth data feeds and react in a flash, learning and changing their behavior along the way. Known as order awareness algos, they harvested data during the execution of a trade and shifted gears in milliseconds. Beneath the technical bells and whistles, however, something more sinister was going on. Order awareness seemed to be another phrase for statistical front-running, using streams of data to trade ahead of those massive whales. With the new electronic pools, the machine learning algorithms Bodek had once toyed with at Hull became viable. As the algo wars heated up, PhDs devised new algos to defend against the hunter-seeker algos. The algos started feeding on one another. They weren't only programmed to gobble up passive food in the market, fat whale orders to buy a million shares of Intel sent down by a fund manager. They were dynamic, aware, capable of watching other algos, anticipating their moves, and eating them too. A mutual fund's algo order to buy Intel would follow strict instructions designed to fake out the hunter seekers. Only buy when many other traders are buying, hiding in the crowd. If the price moves up too quickly, such as 0.5% in 2 minutes, stop buying. If the broader market falls quickly, stop buying. Some algos were encoded with a randomizer, causing them to shift erratically between strategies in order to hide the patterns of their moves. They were like hunted prey, attempting to cover up their tracks through feints and dodges. With no order for the hunter-seeker radars to detect, it was easier to operate in stealth mode. But the hunter-seekers adapted to the new stealth techniques and watched for them, anticipating every move, even the seemingly random ones. Every trade left a signal, a trail of breadcrumbs. The hunter-seekers were experts at sniffing them out. The mindless algos had evolved into dangerous beasts of prey. They were getting smart. They had names such as Shark, Gorilla, Stealth, Thor, Sniper. It was digital warfare taking place inside massive computers. Billions were at stake. Bodek didn't stay long at Goldman. Most of Hull's top people had already left. The creative magic that had driven Hull's machine for years had been suffocated by Goldman's embrace, he felt. In 2003, Bodek landed at UBS and set up shop at the bank's massive Stanford headquarters. The Guinness Book of World Records had dubbed UBS's Stanford trading floor the largest in the world, the size of 2 football fields. At 100,000 square feet, it sported 1,400 seats and 5,000 monitors. It was a computerized trading machine of vast proportions, juggling more than $1 trillion in assets a day. Bodek's mandate was to build an options trading desk that could go head-to-head with the likes of Hull. And he succeeded in spades. His first signal achievement was an entirely new options trading strategy called dynamic sizing. In September 2003, soon after he'd arrived at UBS, he developed a monster algorithm to dominate all others. Using the bank's capital, the algorithm would play an electronic game of chicken by spamming options exchanges with massive orders designed to push aside smaller competitors. By doing so, it got more favorable trades. The idea behind it was simple. Because certain exchanges gave priority to firms that placed large orders, a fat trade could leap ahead of everyone else. Based on a formula, Bodek's algo would dynamically shift the size of its orders to get the best response. Only a small part of the trade would ever get executed, because the trader on the other side wasn't remotely as large. An order to buy 1,000 contracts of Intel options might purchase only 100 contracts, since that's the most that were offered. It was high-stakes electronic poker, and for a time, Bodek was winning every hand. Bodek called it the size game. His desk quickly racked up big profits playing the size game. In short order, other trading firms copied the strategy, triggering a new algo arms race. The game reached absurd levels as firms posted orders as much as 50 times the amount they wanted to trade in order to leap ahead of the competition. As the algos interacted, dialing sizes up and down in order to game one another, the traffic of information shooting through the trading network spiked. It was a classic example of algorithmic evolution. Firms rigged algos to game other algos, dynamically shifting the size of their orders to win the race. It didn't always work perfectly. Bodek's system was coded with a bad trade detection alarm that would blast a loud Homer Simpson-esque "Dope!" whenever a trade was moving against it. One day, after a trader turned on a new feature across the entire portfolio, the bad trade detection system went manic, screaming out more than 500 "dolts" in 4 seconds, like a high-frequency mixtape gone berserk. Bodek's traders soon couldn't bear to watch The Simpsons, since the sound triggered a gut-level panic mode, a twisted trader's version of post-traumatic stress disorder. Volumes surged to insane levels. In 2005, the size game nearly crashed the Oprah feed, run by the Options Price Reporting Authority, the data pipeline feeding the option trading pools. On Wall Street, of course, such events are hailed as career-making victories. By 2006, Bodek was jointly in charge of UBS's elite electronic volatility trading desk, with hundreds of millions of the bank's capital at his fingertips. He worked alongside Tongwei Ko, or TW, his future partner at Trading Machines. Bodek and TW were fish out of water at UBS, two confirmed math nerds in a sea of testosterone-fueled traders. They used to say that they were dolphins in a pool of sharks. Dolphins are known for cooperating in order to defeat predators. Their skills neatly balanced out. Obsessed with risk, TW carefully managed the desk's operation to make sure it didn't blow up. Bodick was more of a gunslinger, pushing the edge of the envelope to maximize returns. But he still wasn't satisfied. He often thought back to his rebellious days as a drummer in a thrash band and the idealism he and his hacker pals had adopted in the early 90s, when a new vision about using technology to break apart the power structures of society had become a rallying cry. The mantra became, "Information wants to be free," and brilliant programmers would do everything they could to make it happen. Then the internet came along, and information on many levels was free. It was a victory for the technorati. But Bodick was still working for a bank. He wanted to be free, to pursue his own dreams. In 2007, he and TW started to discuss launching their own operation, one that would run its own money using Bodick's brilliant strategies and deep knowledge of the market, backed up by TW's obsessive risk management skills. Besides his desire to break out on his own, Bodick also saw that a number of technical changes in the options market were coming, such as a shift from pricing of options in fractions to decimals. Typically, an option trader could buy an option for, say, a dollar, and resell it for $1.05. Decimal pricing would change that. An option trader might buy the option for a dollar and be able to resell it for only $1.01. The shift would make it cheaper for regular investors to get in on the game, but it would make it more difficult for the big boys to make the fat profits they'd grown accustomed to. The difference between buy and sell prices would shrink. Profits of 5 or 10 cents per contract could shrink to a penny. The size game would be crushed. Any firm that put in massive orders would be risking too much for too little reward. To make money, a firm had to be streamlined, able to trade at prices that its competitors thought weren't profitable enough, at least according to the rules of the size game. Rather than hit home runs, Bodick wanted to play small ball, consistently hit lots of singles and doubles, and drive up the score. By creating a new game, while the old outfits were still trying to play the one he'd invented, Bodick would once again have the jump on everyone. And it would be so much easier to do this when he was running his own show. Or so he thought. In the fall of 2007, the two heads of UBS's Electronic Volatility Trading Desk handed in their resignations and launched Trading Machines a mile away in a small office in downtown Stamford. On a clear day, Bodick could see UBS's hulking headquarters from a window in his new digs. Times were good for Bodick. To celebrate his and Elizabeth's 10th wedding anniversary, on October 26, 2007, they tossed a lavish party at the luxurious Waveney House in New Canaan, Connecticut, the former estate of Texaco founder Lewis Lapham. Thrown at the height of the Wall Street bubble, the party was a midnight masquerade ball and cost $60,000. Soon after, Bodick purchased a black BMW Z4M coupe with red leather seats. He called it the Batmobile. Bodick quickly began scouring Wall Street for top talent, and he found eager takers among the trading desks of the most elite banks and hedge funds in the country. Word got around that Bodick and TW were building the next thing in Stamford, a cutting-edge trading operation that reputations would be built on. They turned down dozens of resumes from programmers and traders that most startups would have killed for. They moved fast. In November 2007, Trading Machines launched with $20 million. While small by some standards, it was deemed substantial for a high-speed trading outfit, and spoke to the economics of the business. Fast traders make money by picking up pennies and nickels on thousands of trades a day. Because they move in and out of positions so rapidly, they can recycle a small amount of cash over and over again. Imagine lowering a water-powered generator into a stream of water. The faster the stream, the more energy it generates. The ability to scale up to massive volumes with seemingly little risk, in effect causing the stream to flow more rapidly, was a major reason why high-speed trading had become one of the industry's hottest strategies by the late 2000s. Trading Machines was among the elite at this approach. Deploying roughly $5 million in capital, The rest was set aside for expenses. Trading machines in a single day typically executed 17,000 stock trades and 6,500 options trades. Bodek's trades were all managed by the machine. At the guts of the machine was a computer program he called Pi, a reference to the number, as well as the 1998 movie by Darren Aronofsky that depicts a paranoid mathematician's quest to unearth universal patterns in nature in stock market data. Pi was designed to make a small amount of money for each option or stock traded, make enough trades, and those pennies and nickels could add up to a significant chunk of change, as long as the strategy worked as designed. Powered by more than 100 IBM Blade servers, the machine was plugged into 7 options markets, 4 stock exchanges, and several dark pools. It was fully automated, though traders could jump in and manually trade under certain circumstances, and extremely aggressive. Calculating that most firms wouldn't have the ability to make a profit by rapidly trading options in the decimal era, Bodek believed he'd have a golden opportunity to become a major player by taking the risk and, with TW's help, deploying models sophisticated enough to manage the risk. Trading began in August 2008. The strategy Bodek designed was the culmination of a complex algorithmic trading tradition that had started at Hull and that he'd carried on at Goldman and UBS. He'd started with the premise that he could model the theoretical value of all options as implied by the price of the underlying stock. Throughout the trading day, there were small swings in the prices of the options that signaled to the machine that they had swung away from their true theoretical value. That meant an opportunity. If the price swung too high, the machine would sell the option, expecting to profit when it declined. If the price fell too much, the machine would buy it. The key was to have a model that was both accurate and fast, because other machines were trying to beat it to the punch. The machine had to have massive power so it could calculate these values over and over again and enter the orders into the market thousands of times a minute. It was fierce combat. Trading machines was locked in competition against thousands of players sporting PhDs in everything from quantum physics to electrical engineering to biochemistry. If most of the computer models they deployed judged that Intel was about to rise sharply from $20 a share, the machines would pound the market with buy orders. Sellers, at the same time, often using similar models, rammed up their prices rapidly. Imagine it. Hundreds of thousands of orders flying into the market each second through high-speed connections, fighting to be in front of all the others. Just as quickly, as stocks bobbed and weaved, those orders were canceled and resubmitted at different price points, at different exchanges, and dozens of other trading venues, such as dark pools. Incredibly, a staggering 90% or more of all orders placed into the stock market were canceled. Every second, all day long, every day, this happened again and again and again. Trades fizzing through fiber optic cables laced around the world. The action was so rapid and heavy that no human could do it. It had to be run by machines, high-frequency traders, the speed-freak robot traders of Wall Street. These firms traded both at very high speeds, speeds measured in the millionth or even billionth of a second, and at very high frequencies, meaning the orders they pumped into the market were incredibly frequent, often to the tune of thousands a second. The frenetic frequency of the orders, combined with the insane speeds at which they flew into the market, had created an entirely new market ecosystem that seemed more like something from the Matrix than a place for investors to stash their hard-won earnings. Bodek knew all about the speed traders. Hell, he was one of them. Trading machines was as tooled up as could be, state-of-the-art as a space shot. Its computer layout alone cost more than $3 million a year. But there were several important differences between trading machines and most other high-speed outfits. Bodek's firm specialized in options, whereas most speedsters focused on stocks and ETFs. They were apples and oranges. Options markets were relatively slow compared with stocks. To Bodek, the speed traders of the stock market were insanely fast, turning over positions in a matter of a few seconds. His firm typically held a portfolio of options contracts that rotated at a much slower pace. The high-frequency dimension of the options business centered on managing its risk and inventory as the market shifted. While high speed to most investors, trading machines was a lumbering turtle compared with the rising new breed of speed bots in the stock market. Bodick had also become concerned about the widespread use of artificial intelligence in the market. The options market, with its massive volatility, seemed particularly resistant to AI, which tended to rely on markets behaving in a relatively orderly fashion. He thought of AI like a weather monitoring system for the market. It could detect when the weather was changing and learn from new patterns as it evolved. If the market was like a vast, ever-changing weather system, the AI bots were like satellites that could sense when a cold front was moving in, or a patch of sunny skies. What's more, they could predict patterns by looking for new clues. 60% of the time, a sudden drop in temperature means a thunderstorm is moving in. Run for cover. The trouble, Bodick believed, was that the market could be far more volatile than the weather. It could go from 100 degrees to sub-zero in a matter of minutes. No AI system could ever sense such wild swings. And if it did, it would likely overreact and make the swings worse. That's why Bodick preferred to trust his own brain. While he used AI methods such as expert systems to build his algos, he preferred to maintain control throughout the trading day. That's why he never left his seat, not even for a bathroom break. And it was working. Unlimited riches seemed at Bodick's fingertips. Trading machines was his best shot at the big time, running his own fund, building a trading empire to span the globe. He'd planned to use his windfall to fund research efforts to combat genocide, a long-held dream that went back to his grandparents' narrow escape from Poland after the Nazi invasion of 1939. Bodick had already helped fund one of the earliest Darfur information projects in 2003 and had spent more than $100,000 on projects to intervene in atrocities around the world. But he wanted to do much more. Then the machine stopped working, and Bodick channeled every bit of his brain power toward fixing it. Like the obsessive mathematician in the movie Pi, he shut out all distractions, including his own family, and dove into the data. He even stopped driving the Batmobile, promising himself he'd use it again when he'd solved the mystery. For months, it sat in his front yard, gathering rust. But nothing was working. He'd started wondering if the problem plaguing trading machines wasn't an internal bug. Perhaps, he thought, darting in and out of his screens, were the footprints of an entirely different breed of high-frequency trader, one that made moves he'd never seen before. Maybe, he thought, the game itself had changed. It was as if weather patterns that had existed for years had disappeared entirely. This was not the same stock market he'd encountered at UBS, when he helped run one of the world's largest derivatives trading desks. The very ecosystem of the market itself, driven by the latest advances in the algo wars, seemed to have shifted and morphed into something new, and to Bodick, profoundly disturbing. Chapter 3. Algo Wars. The algo wars had broken out in the late 1990s with the appearance of a small band of computer-savvy trading operations, later dubbed high-frequency traders, with obscure names such as Automated Trading Desk, Getco, Tradebot, and Quantlab. They arose in isolated pockets around the country. Chicago, Mount Pleasant, South Carolina, North Kansas City, Houston, New York. Tiny at first, by the late 2000s, they zipped in and out of stocks at speeds measured in 1/1,000,000th of a second, and accounted for more than 2/3 of all trading of U.S. stocks. They were so skilled, so efficient, and so fast, that they made money nearly every single day. Trading their own cash, they were only interested in short-term profits and rarely held positions overnight. In many ways, they acted like market makers, the ever-present middlemen who bought stocks when others wanted to sell, sold when others wanted to buy. But they were almost entirely unregulated and operated in the shadows of the financial industry. Many of the high-speed firms deployed massive amounts of leverage, or borrowed money, as much as 50 to 1 by the late 2000s. For every dollar they owned, They borrowed another $50 from banks and brokers in the hope of amplifying their profits. As the financial meltdown of 2008 showed, massive leverage can quickly unravel and trigger devastating, out-of-control meltdowns. Over the years, the speed traders worked hand-in-hand with the architects of the electronic pools, the exchange plumbers who catered to their needs like fashion designers wooing movie stars. To the pools, high-frequency trading, commonly called HFT, was like a magical elixir. It brought massive volume, resulting in massive profits. Since the pools made money by executing trades, the more volume they received, the more money they raked in. To lure the traders, the pools offered a smorgasbord of special services. At the top of the list was information, hard data about the state of the market, as well as the activities of other traders. They provided expensive data feeds that channeled a fire hose of information to the bots, which parsed it in microseconds, and reacted in microseconds. The firms that could crunch the data, detect patterns, and react first won the race. The exchanges also offered beneficial status to the firms that poured the most liquidity into their pools. On NASDAQ, a firm that sent 25 million shares a day into its market could qualify for one of its top tiers, which allowed the firm to pocket higher trading fees. On Direct Edge, the top tier once went to firms that sent 40 million shares a day into its pool. The algo wars evolved with AI. If an algo could dynamically adapt to new patterns in the data in the heat of battle, in the midst of the trading day, it could operate more efficiently. In the morning, stocks might trade according to one trend, carried higher by momentum. Then in the afternoon, they might operate according to a new dynamic as investors cashed in their gains. Such trends rippled through the electronic pools in waves throughout the day. The algos tried to surf the waves without getting swamped. As they plunged into the pools, the AI bots started generating entirely new patterns, waves of their own, creating a new trading ecosystem, a market that changed and morphed minute by minute, reacting dynamically to its own twists and turns as in a digitized hall of mirrors, a market that almost seemed alive. As Bodek dug further into the never-ending complexities of high-frequency trading in the stock market, he felt as if he'd finally come out the other end of his father's dream and was once again back in the realm of particle physics. The complexity of the interactions of all the orders was mind-bending. Part of the complexity derived from one of the primary goals in this nanosecond race, to literally get paid to trade. Beginning in the late 1990s, a small group of electronic trading venues, upstart rivals to the NYSE and NASDAQ, launched a payment system that gave trading firms an incentive to send buy and sell orders to their computerized matching engines. Firms that made a trade happen got paid a fraction of a cent per share, while firms that took the trade paid a fraction of a cent per share. The take fee was typically slightly higher than the make fee, and the exchanges pocketed the difference. Eventually, this maker-taker system became the de facto method of trading for the vast majority of the U.S. stock market. Imagine a grocery store in which you can haggle over prices. The grocer is willing to sell you an apple for a dollar. You, however, are offering to pay 95 cents for the apple. If the grocer agrees and takes your lower offer, he pays the take fee while you get the make fee. If, however, you decide to give in and pay a dollar for the apple, you pay the take fee and the grocer gets the make fee. Whoever gives in and crosses the spread between the bid and the offer pays. The system rewards patience and puts a price on speed. Maker-taker provides an incentive for firms to put up lots of price points. Patient market makers can perpetually put up quotes and wait, pocketing the fees. More aggressive and motivated traders who simply must have that apple right now, or must sell that apple, or that apple stock, right now, are more willing to pay the fee. Maker-taker amounted to a frenetic game of musical chairs, with computer-driven firms popping in and out of stocks with the singular goal of snatching the fees. The exchanges loved it, since it boosted their revenues. That, in turn, made the high-frequency firms that specialized in winning the maker-taker game very important to the exchanges. The maker-taker pricing model makes high-frequency traders the exchange's most valuable customers, both through an increase in trading fees and an increase in market data that gets generated, the trade journal Advanced Trading noted in a June 2011 article. Vast sums were at stake. Once a month, firms that made a lot of trades, typically high-frequency trading outfits, received checks from the exchanges paying them for their service. At the same time, firms that took the trades, typically slow-moving large mutual funds, but also outfits such as trading machines that specialized in options but had to trade large sums of stocks, got stuck with a bill. In 2008, for instance, the NYSE and NASDAQ alone paid out $2 billion in make fees, while collecting even more in take fees. And since high-speed traders gravitated to the more speed-friendly exchanges, BATS and Direct Edge, the total amount was surely much higher. It was a game within a game, and it inspired all sorts of perverse behavior. Heavily traded stocks, such as Citigroup and Intel, became beloved by fee-seeking high-speed firms, since the more trades that occurred, the more fees they could collect. Some firms reportedly ramped up trades at the end of the month, even if the trades were losses, simply to surpass specific volume-level targets at the exchanges in order to boost their fees. Firms that averaged, say, 50 million shares a day would get better deals. Regular investors, of course, had little idea about the massive transfer of wealth that was taking place, or that the exchanges, in thrall to the speed traders' oceans of volume, were in on the game and getting paid right alongside the high-frequency traders. In some ways, the market had come full circle. The outfits that could afford the best bandwidth and reach the highest tiers and knew exactly how the plumbing worked had an advantage over everyone else. It was exactly like the specialist system of old, in which insiders lined their pockets at the expense of everyone else. In ways, however, it was worse, because these new computer-driven masters of the universe were almost entirely unregulated. No one was keeping their eyes on the bot's activities. No one could, since no computer on Earth could capture all of the manic nanosecond action. It was a new version of the old stock market, and highly toxic. Bodek began to think it had become broken at its core. If I'm swinging at market phantoms, buying too high, selling too low, what chance do ordinary investors have? It was so complex. The number of destinations for trading stocks was maddening. There were four public exchanges: the NYSE, NASDAQ, Direct Edge, and BATS. The latter two, which specialized in high-speed trading, appeared on the scene in 2005 and 2006, respectively. Inside each of those exchanges were various other destinations. The NYSE had NYSE Arca, NYSE Amex, NYSE Euronext, and NYSE Alternext. NASDAQ had three markets. BATS had two. Direct Edge had Edge A, which had no maker-taker system, and Edge X, which did. Then there were the dark pools. Giant banks ran most of them. Credit Suisse owned the largest, Dan Matheson's Crossfinder. Goldman Sachs' Sigma X was a close second. There was LiquidNet, and Posit, and Pipeline. NASDAQ's European dark pool was called Neuro Dark. Chicago's GETCO, short for Global Electronic Trading Company, the largest and most powerful high-frequency trading firm, it was likely the most active trading operation the world had ever seen, also ran a pool called Get Matched. In all, there were more than 50 dark pools in the United States. While dark pools had been originally designed for large investors as a haven from the hunter-seeker algos, by the late 2000s, most had been thoroughly penetrated by bots. Indeed, they couldn't operate without them. This led to new problems. Toxic dark pools swarming with predator algos designed to front-run large trader orders and game the lit market. The very problem Dan Matheson was trying to fix with Lightpool. Then there were the internalizers, hedge funds such as Citadel Investment Group, based in Chicago, a giant New Jersey shop called Knight Trading, and banks such as Citigroup or Bodek's old haunt, UBS, bought orders from retail brokers such as TD Ameritrade, Charles Schwab, and E-Trade, and executed the trades inside their own computer pools. They matched buy and sell orders internally rather than route them to an exchange. A day trader snapping up 100 shares of Apple from her home office account had little chance of ever actually trading on the NYSE. Instead, she was interacting with a sophisticated program crafted by a team of PhD quants working for a giant Chicago hedge fund or a secretive desk within a Swiss bank. The effect was to remove from the rest of the market the mom-and-pop retail flow and segregate it within isolated pools. And while the internalizers bragged about the quality of their execution, investors using those systems would have been wise to wonder just why a Chicago hedge fund or Swiss bank wanted to pay millions of dollars a year for their orders. The market was pools within pools, all connected electronically, forming a single sloshing pool of dark electronic liquidity. By 2012, the amount of stock trading that took place in dark pools and internalizers was a whopping 40% of all trading volume, and it was growing every month. Even the lit markets were unfathomably complex, run by giant computers that processed secret trading strategies designed by physicists, chemists, PhD mathematicians, AI computer programmers. The strategies were dueling and dodging, processing orders at mind-boggling rates. In late 2011, for instance, NASDAQ rolled out a platform called BurstStream that gave clients the ability to get data in 600 nanoseconds, 600 billionths of a second, with its nanospeed market data mesh system. In the options market, nearly 9 million orders flowed through the system each second, overwhelming computer programs and making a hash of trading information. All of that turnover was having a real-world impact on stocks. At the end of World War II, the average holding period for a stock was 4 years. By 2000, it was 8 months. By 2008, it was 2 months. And by 2011, it was 22 seconds, at least according to one professor's estimates. One founder of a prominent high-frequency trading outfit once claimed his firm's average holding period was a mere 11 seconds. No one truly knew what was taking place inside the guts of this Frankenstein's monster of a market. Chapter 4. Zero Plus. In early December 2009, Chaim Bodek finally solved the riddle of the stock trading problem that was killing trading machines. He was attending a party in New York City, sponsored by a U.S. exchange. He'd been complaining for months to the exchange about all the bad trades, the runaway prices, the fees that were bleeding his firm dry. But he'd gotten little help, and he'd finally stopped using the exchange altogether. At the bar, he cornered an exchange representative and pushed for answers. The rep asked Bodek what order types he'd been using to buy and sell stocks. Order types were how trading firms talked to exchanges, the language they used to communicate their intentions. They determined how a buy or sell order interacted with other orders. A market order essentially told the exchange to buy the stock now, no matter what. They were for urgent traders who didn't care if the market moved in the next few seconds. Limit orders, used by many professional traders, specified that an investor wanted to buy or sell a stock within a limit. A limit order might tell the exchange to buy Intel for up to $20.50, but no higher. They protected investors from sudden swings. They were the kind of orders Bodek used at trading machines. That's what he told the exchange rep. The rep smirked and took a sip of his drink. You can't use those, he told Bodek. Why not? You have to use other orders. Those limit orders are going to get run over. But that's what everyone uses, Bodek said, incredulous. That's what Schwab uses. I know, you shouldn't. As the rep started to explain undocumented features about how limit orders were treated inside the exchange, Bodek started to scribble an order on a napkin, detailing how it went into the exchange. "You're fucked in that case?" he said, shoving the napkin at the guy. "Yeah." He scribbled another. "You're fucked in that case?" "Yeah." "Are you telling me you're fucked in every case?" "Yeah." "Why are you telling me this?" "We want you to turn us back on again," the rep replied. "You see, you don't have a bug." Bodek's jaw dropped. He'd suspected something was going on inside the market that was killing his trades, that it wasn't a bug, but it had been only a vague suspicion with little proof. "I'll show you how it works." The rep told Bodek about the kind of orders he should use. Orders that wouldn't get abused like the plain vanilla limit orders. Orders that seemed to Bodek specifically designed to abuse the limit orders by exploiting complex loopholes in the market's plumbing. The orders Bodek had been using were child's play, simple declarative sentences sent to exchanges, such as, "Buy up to $20. These new order types were compound sentences with multiple clauses, virtually Faulknerian in their rambling complexity. The end result, however, was simple. Everyday investors, and even sophisticated firms like trading machines, were buying stocks for a slightly higher price than they should, and selling for a slightly lower price, and paying billions in take fees along the way. In part, it had to do with a massive market structure change instituted by the Securities and Exchange Commission in 2007, known as Reg NMS, short for Regulation National Market System. It had been an attempt to bind together the fragmented electronic marketplace into a single interlinked web of trading, a true national market system. The only way to do this, a team of technocrats at the SEC decided, was to mandate that any order to buy or sell a stock had to go to the venue that had the best price. If an investor placed an order to buy Intel at the NYSE, where it was selling for $20.01, and there was a better price at NASDAQ, say $20, the order would instantly be routed to NASDAQ. The prices were shared among exchanges and dark pools on an electronic ticker tape called the Securities Information Processor, widely known as the SIP feed. While Reg NMS made some intuitive sense, it also spawned a vast tangle of complications. Now, all trading venues had to constantly monitor the price of a stock, or hundreds or thousands of stocks, on every trading venue all the time, a feat that required industrial-strength computer power. Because of this linkage, the national market system regulated when the best bid or offer for a stock was permitted to change within each exchange or dark pool. If prices changed, one result could be that an order placed into an exchange's trading queue was either rejected, routed to another exchange, or kicked to the back of the queue. The lineup of buy or sell orders ranked according to priority. Whoever was first in line got the trade. This made life very complex for obsessively detail-oriented firms that wished to microscopically control every aspect of how their orders were treated by an exchange. And evidently, some complained about it. The exchanges, eager to please their most favored clients, rolled out new order types that would solve the problem. While these order types were free, many firms without the proper plumber expertise and exchange guidance couldn't use them. The special order types that gave Bodek the most trouble, the kind the exchange rep told him about, allowed high-frequency traders to post orders that remained hidden at a specific price point at the front of the trading queue when the market was moving, while at the same time pushing other traders back. Even as the market ticked up and down, the order wouldn't move. It was locked and hidden. It was dark. This got around the problem of reshuffling and rerouting. The sitting duck limit orders, meanwhile, lost their priority in the queue when the market shifted, even as the special orders maintained their priority. Why would the high-speed firms wish to do this? Recall those maker-taker fees that generate billions in revenue for the speed bots every year. By staying at the front of the queue and hidden as the market shifted, the firm could place orders that, time and again, were paid the fee. Other traders had no way of knowing that the orders were there. Over and over again, their orders stepped on the hidden trades, which acted effectively as an invisible trap that made other firms pay the take fee. While that seemed intuitively unfair, it was even worse. Bodek learned that when his limit orders were reposted in the queue as the market ticked due to the complex Reg NMS quirks, when the market went higher or lower, trade orders were frequently reshuffled. They were often dropped right on top of the hidden orders, forcing trading machines to pay the fee. It was fiendishly complex. The order types were pinned to a specific price, such as $20.05, and were hidden from the rest of the market until the stock hit that price. As the orders shifted around in the queue, the trap was set, and the orders pounced. In ways, the exchange had created a dark pool inside the lit pool. "You're totally screwed unless you do that," the rep at the bar said. Bodek was astonished and outraged. He'd been complaining to the exchange for months about the bad executions he'd been getting, and had been told nothing about the hidden properties of the order types, until he'd punished the exchange by cutting it off. He was certain they'd known the answer all along, but they couldn't tell everyone, because if everyone started using the abusive order types, no one would use limit orders, the food the new order types fed on. Bodek felt sick to his stomach. "How can you do that?" he said. "Isn't that illegal?" The rep laughed. "It probably should be illegal, but if we changed things, the high-frequency traders wouldn't send us their orders," he said. "They'd go to other pools that had similarly abusive order types." As he drove home that night, Bodek processed what he'd been told. Nearly every trading firm in the United States, mutual funds, bank desks, pension funds, used limit orders to buy and sell stocks. They were the meat and potatoes of the professional trading world. The market had been designed for limit orders. An insider's term for the market itself was a central limit order book, a CLOB in the industry jargon. No less than USA Today told investors that the best, easiest, and free way for investors to protect themselves in this era of electronic trading is to use so-called limit orders that safeguard against short-term disruptions that might be caused by computerized trading. But a representative for a U.S. exchange had just told Bodek not to use limit orders, which were getting picked off by high-speed traders like ducks in a pond. Bodek thought practically nonstop for days about what the exchange representative had told him that night at the New York party. The way that the abusive order types worked made him think back to a document he'd been given by a colleague that summer as he researched what was going wrong at trading machines. The document was a detailed blueprint of a high-frequency method that was said to be popular in Chicago's trading circles. It was called the zero-plus scalping strategy. Bodek suspected there might be a link between the order types and the strategy. Riffling through his files, he quickly found it. While the document didn't say which firm used the strategy, he'd been told by the colleague who'd given it to him that one of the most successful high-speed firms employed it, or something closely akin to it. Due to the sophistication of the strategy, he'd guessed from the start that it was probably written by a plumber. There was another giveaway that it had originated in Chicago, where Bodek had worked for several years at Hull Trading. Scalping. To a trader, scalping didn't mean the same thing it meant to most people. A suspicious-looking guy peddling tickets for a sporting event or a rock concert outside a stadium. In trading, scalping was an age-old strategy of buying low and selling high very quickly. It was a common practice on the floors of futures exchanges that populated the Midwest, the Kansas City Board of Trade, or the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. The zero-plus scalping strategy was apparently a futures trading technique that had been transformed into a computer program. Bodek started reading. Page 2 of the document laid out the purpose of the Zero Plus strategy. Simple goal. Use market depth and our order's priority in the queue to create scalping opportunities where the loss on any one trade is limited to zero, exclusive of commissions. Bodek paused at that. Essentially, the author of the strategy was saying that its primary goal was to never lose money. The loss on any trade was zero. In theory, this could be done through a scalping strategy. By being first in the queue, shorthand for the queue in which orders are stacked up, like theatergoers waiting in line for their tickets, the firm could always get the best trade at the best time. But what happened when the firm didn't want to buy or sell? Bodek kept reading. Goal restatement. Use the market depth and our order's priority in the queue to create scalping opportunities where the probability of a plus one tick gain on any given trade is substantially greater than the probability of a minus one tick loss on any given trade. Aha, Bodek thought. Market depth. That was a reference to the orders behind this firm's orders, the other theatergoers waiting in line. The Zero Plus trader is assuming that his firm is so fast and so skilled that it can almost always get priority in the trading queue, be the first to buy and the first to sell. The depth behind it, the other orders, is the rest of the market. The author is saying, I always want to win, or rather, I never want to lose. His probability of winning, a plus one tick, is substantially greater than a minus one tick loss. But how? The rest of the market, suckers like trading machines or everyday mutual funds, was insurance. Under the next heading, called Simple Premises, the exact meaning of what insurance meant was spelled out. If we have sufficient depth behind our order at a given price level, then we are effectively self-insured against losing money. Why? If we get elected on our order, we could immediately exit our risk for a scratch by trading against one of the orders behind us. In other words, if the Zero Plus trader buys a stock, gets elected, and his algos suddenly detect that the price is likely to fall, they can see a large number of sell orders stacking up in the trading queue, he can flip and sell to the sucker standing behind him, resulting in a scratch. No gain and no loss. He can do this because his computer systems can react fast enough to changing market conditions to always achieve, in the worst case, a scratch or a cancel of our orders. Bodek was floored as he realized what this meant. It was the holy grail of trading. The Zero Plus trader was describing a strategy that effectively never lost. The rest of the market protected it whenever the firm's algorithms detected the slightest chance that the market was moving against it. It's brilliant and diabolical. Bodek thought carefully about what this meant. A firm that has found a strategy that is virtually guaranteed to win on every trade has discovered a hole in the market. Trading is all about taking risk. But this author was describing a virtually riskless trade. The situation confronting Bodek and other investors not using the Zero Plus strategy was challenging, to say the least. It was like driving a car down the freeway, and every time you tried to speed up, another faster car was in front of you. No matter how many tricks you pulled, this car, a Zero Plus symbol stamped on its hood, of course, was always leading the pack. The only time you could get around it, when it would suddenly hit the brakes and vanish in the crowd behind you, was when a Mack truck was speeding right at you. Worse, the Zero Plus trader was the Mack truck. Say your mutual fund manager wanted to buy 50,000 shares of ExxonMobil. Of course, he wouldn't simply put in an order to buy 50,000 shares at once. The bots would eat him alive. He'd carve it up into slices of 1,000 shares apiece, or even less. He hits the button. The first 1,000 share buy order flies into an exchange. Exxon just happens to be trading for $75.20. But the order isn't executed. It sits there floundering as sellers suddenly start running away. The bots some using the zero-plus scalping strategy or a variant of it, have jumped in front of the fund manager's order, angling to buy ahead of him. The buy orders seemingly materialize out of nowhere. They were hidden. The bots get the trade because they're armed with the special order types that allow them to jump in front of the fund manager. The trade's activated because their radar detector algos sensed that the market was ticking higher. Why? They sensed the fund manager's presence. Suddenly, 200 shares of the fund manager's order are filled for $75.22. But the rest of the order, 800 shares, is still in limbo. The fund manager pounds his desk. What's going on? Exxon ticks up to $75.22, then $75.24, where he gets another 200 shares, leaving 600 unfilled. Exxon hits $75.25, then $75.26. Adding to the confusion, the fund manager has lost track of where his order has gone. It's not clear where it's posted. The NYSE, NASDAQ, Direct Edge, BATS. Perhaps, he thinks, it's floating between the obscure connections linking all the pools together. Exxon ticks up to $75.30. Then sales clear through to $75.35, and the buy order is hit again. The fund manager gets all of his remaining 600 shares. He buys some more as the price ticks higher, even sending some orders into dark pools. He buys as the price moves all the way up to $75.50, where the market stabilizes with a dense concentration of sellers, and shares start executing like water. He buys a total of 10,000 shares for an average price of $75.40. He still has 40,000 shares to go. He decides to wait and sits there watching in disgust as the price crawls back to $75.25. The price is falling now because the bots sense that the fund manager is sitting on the sidelines. But once he starts buying again, the whole game starts over. That's how it works. Regular investors, the suckers using those stupid limit orders, buy high and sell low all the time. Bodek deduced that the Zero Plus document was in effect describing a subspecies of a vast high-frequency trading class, a shared approach that had spread across the industry over the years. It had its own lingo, phrases like self-insurance, sweep risk, the odds of getting blasted by a giant order, and scratch. That kind of evolution takes time to develop. What's more, it was a lingo Bodek had never heard before. Not at Hull, not at Goldman, not at UBS. It was its own world, one very few people knew about. Bodek inferred that the Zero Plus strategy had originally been designed sometime in the mid-2000s. But the market had changed since then, dramatically. There was much more competition. The rules were different. That made it harder for this firm, or any other using a similar strategy, to always win, to always know where it stood in the queue, and to cut and run when things got hot. The pieces started to fall in place. He thought back to what the exchange rep had told him about the exotic order types. The Zero Plus strategy needed new order types to give it more control over the queue against competitors. Orders that didn't pop up and down a tick, that didn't slip and slide around the order book. An unpredictable plus one tick, or negative one tick, plus or minus one penny in other words, could be enough to destroy the strategy, which relied on absolute certainty on a millisecond timescale. It required orders that wouldn't be kicked out of the queue. If the orders were invisible to the rest of the market, even better. Of course, Bodek couldn't be sure that his theory was correct, but it sure seemed to make sense to him, and helped explain why trading machines was getting screwed over and over again in the stock market. Who else knew about this? Surely not the mutual funds. Surely not the poor schlubs trading through their E-Trade and Charles Schwab accounts. Who else had access to this kind of information? The Zero Plus specs, the details about the order types that abused Reg NMS, a set of regulations designed to protect ordinary investors and give them the best prices. And who would tell? The exchanges needed the dumb limit orders to feed the sharks. At the same time, booking fees from all the trades they triggered. The speed traders who used it were getting filthy rich. Mutual funds were feeding billions to high-frequency traders every year, cash coming straight out of the pockets of everyday investors. It was almost invisible, pennies per trade. Those endless plus-one ticks, the tail-chasing ups and downs, plaguing fund managers trying to buy their